This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, April 8th, 2015. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, a few poems from Charles Wright. Charles Wright is the author of over 20 books of poetry, and he's one of our most celebrated poets. In 2014, he was appointed Poet Laureate of the United States. Charles Wright is still Poet Laureate, at least until the Library of Congress names a new one. If you haven't heard much about him this past year, that's because he has not been an activist laureate like Billy Collins or Natasha Trethewey were. He said at the time he was named, "I'll probably stay here at home and think about things," which seems like what a poet should do, I think. Charles Wright is sitting in a studio in Manhattan, and we've asked him to read a few poems. Charles, when you're reading a poet that you like, do you also go back and listen to how they read specific poems? Did you go back, for instance, and listen to Ezra Pound reading his stuff? Because I know you were, at one point at least, very interested in Ezra Pound.
I have not.
Really? You've never heard Ezra Pound?
I heard him read a few poems somewhere years ago, but I've never, you know, put on a record and listened to him.
Huh. So do you not, you don't want necessarily value audio recordings of poets reading their own work, or they don't bring anything special?
I guess this is heresy, but that doesn't really interest me as much as the lines on the page and the music that comes off the page and into my head.
So the whole emphasis on kind of orality and poetry that's come about in the last, I don't know, 50 years basically, but mainly in the last 15 years with the internet really growing, you're not so interested in that.
Well, I have to say no, actually.
That's totally fine, but we're gonna go with it anyway. We're going to have you read. Yeah. I have a feeling that people will want to hear how you read your poems. Now, we've recorded you in the past, and we already have recordings of several of your poems up on the site, but we wanted to get some more. In particular, we wanted to get two poems from your book, Chickamauga, from 1996. Would you tell us just a little bit about the title poem, Chickamauga? The only thing I know about it is the Battle of Chickamauga of 1863, when the South defeated the North in one of the biggest battles of the Civil War. I suspect that you know quite a bit more about Chickamauga. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I don't know much more about it, but it is the battle in which my great-grandfather was wounded out of the war, and then he spent 2 years in a northern prison. And so it's always been an interesting thing to me. This poem is sort of about history. This whole book, Chickamauga, was an attempt on my part to scramble things and to talk about writing itself inside the poems. I thought that was such a cool idea at the time, and I'm not sure it is now. There's a disjointedness to these poems. Of course, there's a disjointedness to all my poems, but this little spate was particularly, I don't know, targeted.
Mm-hmm. At a certain point, it becomes a poem about writing poetry. And now you have you have doubts about the value of that? It's a lot of poets do that nowadays.
Well, I have doubts about all my poems, of course, you know. You love them until about half an hour after you've written them, and then you say, "What is that?"
You know, it's funny. I don't find this poem terribly disjointed, but I guess you must have felt that when you read it.
It's in five sections, and each section is sort of self-sufficient and is not connected to the one before it or the one after. But I had hoped that at the end of the poem, there would be some kind of continuity, which is how I write all of my sectioned poems, that they may not flow in a narrative way, but at the end of the poem, there is a coming together of parts and that they give some kind of overall meaning.
Would you give it a read?
Sure. Chickamauga. Dove twirl in the tall grass. End of summer glaze next door on the gloves and split ends of the conked magnolia tree. Work sounds. Truck backup beep. Wood tin hammer. Cicada. Fire horn. History handles our past like spoiled fruit. Mid-morning, late century light calicoed under the peach trees. Fingers us here. Fingers us here and here. The poem is a code with no message. The point of the mask is not the mask, but the face underneath. Absolute, incommunicado, unhoused and peregrine. The gill net of history will pluck us soon enough from the cold waters of self-contentment we drift in, one by one, into its suffocating light and air. Structure becomes an element of belief, syntax and grammar a catechist. Their words what the beads say, words thumb to our discontent.
I've noticed that this poem, like most of your poems, starts out in a very specific place.
It was in my backyard.
In your backyard, okay. A lot of your poems start in your backyard, I believe, where the poet is where you are looking out at the world and carefully observing things. Why do you suppose you work in that way? Why do you like to start in a very specific place and then work from there?
Well, place is very important to me, and I'm not a thinky poet. In other words, poems don't start out with an idea for me. They start out with something I've seen or I'm looking at or remembered looking at. And so they usually go from a description to another description, but there's always something going on behind what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Everything starts with what I see.
It does go from what you see into ideas eventually. There's a line that really stands out to me, at least. The poem is a code with no message. And then it goes on to explain, the point of the mask is not the mask, but the face underneath, absolute, incommunicado, unhoused, and peregrine. To me, that says the poem is a kind of mask for the poet, and that the poet doesn't necessarily know who he or she is. Is that a fair reading of that stanza?
That's fair, but it's also the mask is what's always going on behind the poem. And it's always something quite different from what it presents itself most of the time. That's what I had in mind there.
But the mask, even though it's different, it has value in and of itself.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's what you're getting at there. And then it goes into history with this marvelous stanza, the gill net of history will pluck us soon enough from the cold waters of self-contentment we drift in, one by one, into its suffocating light and air. You could have left that just waters. Why is it the cold waters?
Because history is never what we think it is, and we think we're up to snuff with everything that we think we believe in. In fact, we're not. History is a cold water.
Yeah, it sure is. And we think we know what we're doing, and then history comes and suffocates us.
Yeah.
And pulls us out like fish. And then you get into structure. Structure becomes an element of belief, syntax, a grammar and catechist, their words, what the beads say, words thumbed to our discontent. And here we're back in the realm of poetry about why you write poetry.
Well, yeah, but this is one of the spots where I am talking about how a poem is put together and what it means beyond what it says.
But it's an element of belief, syntax and grammar, a catechist. It makes it seem poetry is very, very important in this poem, yet it seems like a wan hope at the same time.
Well, everything's a wan hope, isn't it?
I guess so.
All my poems are kind of meditative, contemplative, and even, I guess, I hate to say it, but devotional to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
And I think of each of the parts of my poems is beads, worry beads or prayer beads that you go from one to the next to the next. But it's all a big circle, so everything comes back to where you started, which is what meditation does. And it's why my poems seem to be so repetitive, because they are repetitive, because they're meditational and they're contemplative.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful way to think about it. Do you ever feel like you're writing a poem that you wrote 30 years ago?
I'm afraid I've been writing the same poem for about 50 years. That's true. You know, we all have two or three ideas. That's about it. And you work them over and over and over. And I do it on purpose, which is fortunate since I couldn't do anything else, but I do it on purpose because of what I just said, that they're my devotions, you know.
Let me ask you to read another poem from the same book. This one is called Sitting Outside at the End of Autumn. Do you remember writing this poem? It's been a long time.
I don't know if I do or not. I mean, I wrote a lot of poems sitting in the backyard of my of my house in Charlottesville.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't write them in the backyard. I'd take notes and go in the house and write them, you know, so it made some sense.
Right.
But I remember the period of time that I was writing these poems.
Mm-hmm.
I was concentrating very much on the, God, I hate to say this, but on the spiritual side of what I was doing.
When you say you hate to spell it out and talk about spiritual, and earlier you said you didn't want to call yourself a devotional poet, why do you hate that?
I don't know. I think it's pretentious.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I write the poems, and I don't like to talk about that part of them, you know, because I'm not a church-going guy. I'm not this. I fell from grace at the age of 16, but it all stayed with me, of course, and it comes out in the poems.
At the age of 16, when you fell from grace, was that because you discovered poetry? Did poetry ruin you, in other words?
No, it's because I got tired of going to church. I didn't discover poetry till I was 23 years old.
And I think you were in Italy, right?
I was in the army in Italy, yes, at the time.
And what moved you into poetry?
I don't know. You know, I read this poem that I liked a lot. I had always kind of wanted to write, but I couldn't tell a story. I couldn't do narrative.
Mm.
And this poem was imagistic, and it moved imagistically.
What poem was that?
It was called Blandula Tenula Vagula by Ezra Pound. And it was about a spot, Sirmione Peninsula, in Lake Garda, which is right next to the town of Verona, where I was billeted, where I lived. I thought it really sounded good. And then later I realized it was iambic pentameter, so it sounded so good. Oh, I didn't know that. You know, I still didn't know that until, I don't know, 15 years later.
Uh-huh.
But I liked it. And I said, well, maybe I could do this, since it doesn't have to tell a story. It just moves from one series of images to another and then kind of coagulates at the end. And I like that.
That's a very good description of what your poems do.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. Can I get you to read Sitting Outside at the End of Autumn?
You can. Sitting Outside at the End of Autumn. 3 years ago, in the afternoons, I used to sit back here and try to answer the simple arithmetic of my life, but never could figure it. This object and that object never contained the landscape, nor all of its implications. This tree and that shrub never completely satisfied the sum or quotient I took from or carried to, nor do they do so now, though I'm back here again, looking to calculate, looking to see what adds up. Everything comes from something. Only something comes from nothing, Lao Tzu says, more or less. Eminently sensible, I say, rubbing this tiny snail shell between my thumb and two fingers, delicate as an earring. It carries its emptiness like a child it would be rid of. I rub it clockwise and counterclockwise, hoping for anything resplendent in its vocabulary or disguise. But one and one make nothing, he adds, endless and everywhere, the shadow that everything casts.
Okay, Charles Wright, thanks for coming on and recording some of your poems.
You're welcome.
Charles Wright is the Poet Laureate of the United States. You can read a bunch of his poems on our website and listen to him reading a handful of them. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.